Yeti.
Yes.
Oh, wow. It actually worked on the first try.
You're the Linux desktop right there.
Yeah, dude.
Oh, hi, hi.
Hello.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
Look at us. Look at us go. Hello, talking heads. How are you this afternoon? You're on mute, Polly, and I don't like it.
Ah, that's better.
Yeah, there we go. Alt-A. All right. For non-Mac users, Alt-A is pretty dope.
First of all, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm a lazy, lazy human being and did not publish last week's, and I'm sorry about that.
So if you're listening to the podcast, that makes no sense because they'll hear it whenever they hear it, and they don't know what week you're talking about because they're not timestamped, and that's not how podcasts work.
Oh, I guess it's true. Okay. All right. Well, never mind then.
Love you for the confessional, but it's not that kind of show.
That's true.
And we only do that once a year where I come from.
Is that what that's not, it's not Yom Kippur? Is that the,
yeah.
That's,
look at
that's
you
next
go.
Week, right? Isn't that next God. Week?
I don't think so. I didn't say I was a good Jewish observant person. It's usually in September, and it looks like it's, yeah, end of September. Plenty of time to build up the guilt.
All right. End of September. All right. I just know that last year we had our major conference on at that time, and our major conference is next week, so my brain was putting the two together.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't help that the Hebrew calendar doesn't align to the Gregorian calendar, so... It's always a hodgepodge planning year over year conferences with
people. That's a bit gregarious.
Hey.
Somebody's live this afternoon, folks.
I should have grabbed a beer before we started.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah.
All Probably right. Sure. Well, we'll just have to do it with that beer, won't we? So what do we got going on? Hey, you know, I had lunch today. And
oh, nice.
One of those lunches where you're like, fuck it, I'm just going to eat over the sink. I know it's going to be messy. I know it's going to be delicious. I don't want to clean up after myself. I'm just going to eat over the sink. So I grilled up a burger and I put like 3 thick slices of cheese on it and got it all gooey and put a bunch of barbecue sauce on it. And so I knew it was going to be very messy. And there's something so... delightful about eating over the sink.
So you like paint us a picture. Are you like sidestepped on the sink, like kind of leaning over it and observing some room in your house? Or are you like, is there a window you're observing, or are you just like staring at the meat?
Look, eating is serious business. I'm focused on the food. No, we do have a window, but in all honesty, I was mostly focused on the food.
I like it. I don't know where I stand on that as a practice. I feel like I'm inclined to say I like sink eating, but I guess I'm more of like a grazer. Like I want to be nomadic with it. Like I'll walk around with a sandwich or like a, you know, warmed up piece of pizza, and you don't want to get a plate, and you know, you just want to, you know, observe your kingdom and wander around a bit. You know, the walking philosopher type of lunch. How about you, JJ?
So eating a hamburger over a sink seems like a lot more work than it's worth, in my opinion. Like I would rather just put a plate down, because I'm a very messy eater, especially hamburgers. For whatever reason, they just fall apart on me all the time. So like I know if I ate over a sink, it would fall into the sink because parts of it would fall off or whatever, and it would just be a disaster. So I even have, as on an audio podcast, it's great to show it. I even have a plate like right beside me. So when I am eating, like at my desk or whatever, it's in, so I don't like drip everywhere.
But wait, if you're so messy, you can't eat over the sink. You definitely should not be eating over that expensive Dvorak keyboard.
But well, no, I'm not. It's pushed forward. That is true. But that's the reason why I have the plate here, because I know it's just going to fall apart on me. But that brings me up to an interesting question. So you had a hamburger for lunch. Believe it or not, I've just recently in my older age discovered grilled cheeses. I didn't grow up with them as a kid. I genuinely didn't. The number of times I've had grilled cheeses up until CZ introduced me to them at another place, no joke, it was less than five in my whole life.
That's horrific.
So being that I bake bread, a lot of my bread I use to make grilled cheeses, but I want to ask my brain trust here, what are the cheeses you put inside your grilled cheeses? Because it's not, there's a whole world of this stuff. And this is a hard question to ask.
So I use whatever cheese I happen to have in my fridge, like first and foremost.
Okay.
But if I have, say, Gruyere, that's great. If I have like a sharp or extra sharp cheddar, that's also great. Okay. Swiss is great. And I'll often do like a combination of the two. And depending on what I've got in the house, sometimes I use slices, sometimes I use grated, sometimes I use both. Actually, if we want to get into branding, the Tillamook like four cheese cheddar blend is really good. It has they've got really thick grates, which is good, but also it's like got some cheddar in it. It's got some mozzarella in it, and I can't remember what the other two are. But that's a pretty good mix. And I've recently started getting this other cheese, which is a Gruyere mix with some other things. Okay. And I use that primarily for when I'm making a broccoli and Gruyere soup. But I've started using a little bit of that in things like grilled cheese as well, because it just adds enough of the sort of Gruyere and those other kind of interesting flavors in.
I like that. I'm going to lean on the bougie side. Like, I think like a mild Swiss is really nice. And especially with a light layer of like whole seed mustard to give it like some tang. And like, that's my absolute favorite go-to snack would be those. If you want to like elevate it even further, like do some very thin, like green apple slices in there. And that sounds also insane, but is delicious once you give it a go.
I'm all for that. Yeah. One of my favorite snacks used to be back in Australia is, I don't do it so much because Vegemite's a precious commodity, but I would spread Vegemite on some lightly toasted toast, and I would put a slice of cheese on that, and then I would put a cheese side up under the broiler until the cheese melted. And then if I felt a little bit extra, I would drizzle a little bit of honey or maple syrup on top.
Oh, wow.
That's delicious, right? You got sweet, savory, salty.
And then garbage, the Vegemite.
Literally garbage.
Literal garbage.
The pine scum of nutrition.
We cook the garbage down into a thick paste.
Yeah,
not raw garbage.
Exactly.
A dumpster fire is still a dumpster fire. Just saying. Just silly.
Or is it just a modern smoker? Who knows?
Hey. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, just to kind of throw my two cents in, I'm very simple. I just use Colby Jack cheese and Munster cheese. Seems to be a pretty solid win. Man.
It's nothing just about that. That's two good cheeses to
yeah,
put in.
Oh, it is. I literally know nothing about cheese. I didn't grow up with cheese. Like I'm pretty much discovering this stuff in real time.
Yeah. Like if you're at the like deli counter Boar's Head sort of range of cheese, you've named like a couple of really good ones to go for.
Oh.
Right. You're not going to the like the deli and getting that like the fancy cheese shop and getting the, you know, the really soft, gooey French like cheeses, but
yeah,
you're also don't want that for a grilled cheese. No. I mean, you can, but really you don't, because you want cheese with some good body to them. So I think you've done well. And also those cheeses, especially from like the supermarket deli, tend to have the better melting properties because they often have a little bit of that plasticky cheese kind of feel to it, which for a grilled cheese is perfect. You want that, like, you don't want it to split when it melts. And a lot of, like, unprocessed cheeses, I mean, all cheese is processed, obviously, because it's cheese, but the less processed cheeses will split when they melt. And that's why, like, with a French cheese sauce or a queso, you traditionally make a roux first with flour, and then you add some milk or whatever, then you add the cheese, because the flour and the thickness from the flour helps keep the cheese in an emulsion as it's cooked. But actually, that's the other type of grilled cheese, is the old croque-monsieur, croque-madame.
Oh, yeah.
Where you make that, I can't remember the name of the cheese, but you basically, you make a roux, so like butter and flour. You cook it. You want it nice and blonde. You don't want to darken it up or anything. You cook it until it's, you know, got the flour cooked. You add a bunch of milk, you know, you sort of mix it until it's thick, then you add a ton of cheese, and that is then perfect to go like in a grilled cheese, or to like pour on top of a grilled cheese and then stick it under the broiler. And also if you're into vegetables and cheese, which I know you are, JJ, you can do like a broccoli and cheese melt. So you basically, you mostly cook some broccoli, you don't want it like overcooked, and like in the microwave is fine, and then you put that cheese sauce over the top of it, and then you stick it in the oven until the cheese sort of browns up, and it's super delicious.
Nice. So do you use butter on the grill for your grilled cheeses, or do you use something different?
So I don't have any religious observances. I'll kind of use what's available. I mean, as long as I have some kind of fat, I'm happy. Butter is great. I'm also partial to the mayo trick. But if I do that, I'll... Yeah. So mayonnaise is oil, egg yolk, a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of mustard that's been... what do you emulsified, right?
Okay.
But it's like 95 or 98% oil. So if you heat it up, it'll split into those component pieces and give you a perfect cooking, like, oil. Some mayos will give you kind of a oddish sort of aftertaste when you do that. But if you use like a really good like mayo, or you reach for like the Koopy mayo, it actually works out pretty well. It's a really good trick for if you're trying to grill chicken, because it will stick. It'll like stick to the chicken long enough through the cooking to make sure that this chicken doesn't really stick to the grill. So it's a pretty nifty hack there. And people will do steaks and stuff with it as well. I'm not going that far. I feel like it has its limits. And I think like if you're gonna grill a chicken breast, which I'm not a huge fan, unless you like flatten it out a bit and like try and grill it as quickly as possible, I find a little bit of mayo helps a lot there. Helps it from not stick to the like the bars of your grill or whatever.
That's pretty. I would never have thought of that, huh? Yeah. Wait, time out. Why don't you grill chicken? Just because the drying out of it, or?
Yeah. So. I mean, it dries out really easy. Basically, if you cook it to like the 165, which is the old school, like safe temperature for chicken, it's like super dry, right? I will usually go to about 145 or so, and then let it get to about 150, like as it rests. And I'm cool with that. Even a little bit lower is fine if I know it's a decent chicken. But also the shape of it, right? You know, it's like a teardrop shape almost. So that's why I'll almost always like beat it with the bottom of a pan or a hammer to sort of flatten it out a little bit. Just the round a bit, just so it's a more even shape. And that also helps you cook it to a char pretty quickly without overcooking the inside, because you can use sort of a higher heat because you're not.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Such thickness.
Huh.
But that's usually, if I'm grilling chicken, I would much rather go for thighs.
Yeah.
Because yeah, thighs like a higher internal temperature because of the type of meat they are. So taking those to 165, even to like 175, 180 is totally fine. And you still get like a really good, juicy meat.
Yeah.
So it can be a thigh anytime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weissman,
I'm a convert.
Yeah. Well, Weissman really does say use thighs every time. But we try to, we've sort of learned to buy bone-in thighs, but it's a lot of work to debone chicken thighs.
Like, what do you need to debone them for?
Well, I mean, it's you see
what your teeth are for.
Well, if you're gonna like fry it, right, or whatever, like we've been trying to get into frying chicken, and just like an actual like oil and all that jazz, mm-hmm. because you know you can't leave the house, so occasionally you want to fry like a hot fried chicken sandwich, right?
Sure.
And well, unfortunately, we only do this on the weekends, so because for obvious reasons. Like life gets in the way, but on a weekend mm-hmm. you can spend the time doing all the prep work and all. My question though, this is leading into a question about frying chicken. Do you use egg to fry, to do the batter, or do you just put the batter on the chicken directly? Or is it dealer's choice?
I mean, it depends. It's dealer's choice. I normally do the dredging flour, dredging egg. Dredging flour again.
Shower.
So tricks for the flour is like the best flour to use is the, have you seen Wondra? It's like gold medal, I think is the brand.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's like a partially pre-cooked flour. And so it's already been jellified or whatever the right term is. And so it's a much finer flour. And just because of the pre-treatment it's been through, it gives you a really good crispy surface. Mm. So I like to reach for that. If you don't have that, you can replace out some of your flour with like potato starch or cornstarch and get a similar effect. Some of the Asian frying methods are all starch, but I find that is a little bit too much unless you're really going for like a wet batter and doing like a tempura. So I totally think that. The other thing, you can get a toasted soybean flour at your Asian grocery, and that gives some really good, delicious, toasty flavors in there as well. And you only sort of use a fairly small amount of that.
So do you put cayenne pepper or anything else other than flour in your flour dredge?
Oh yeah. I season the shit out of that thing.
Like what is shit in this case? Like how much, like I've done it before where I've like tried to dump like what I thought was a lot of cayenne pepper in there to get cayenne flavor to mm-hmm. do the dry, like in my mind, it's wet chicken, dry in flour, egg, breadcrumbs, right? That's kind of the safe one that I've been using.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Is that wrong?
So actually, if I'm using breadcrumbs, I'll of course reach for panko because they're like breadcrumbs, but better.
Yep.
And then you're also kind of going almost for that like Japanese katsu style. Mm-hmm. But what you just described is perfect. And yeah, I would season that flour. Well, so you're either going to season
though.
The chicken.
You need a lot.
So
no.
Either season the chicken or season the flour, right?
Oh.
So you can do like a wet brine in buttermilk and season that and then just use a more plain flour. Or if you don't do that wet brine first, then you would season your flour.
Mm. Okay. Okay. I'm with you.
Or don't. Like it's still fried and it's still delicious, but
yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, also a little bit of MSG in that goes a long way. Like
yes.
I don't care, all those MSG haters, they can hate on MSG all they want, but they are missing out. It is delicious and there is nothing wrong with it. It is basically ground up seaweed.
Yeah. And doesn't our body create the enzyme also? Like there's no,
I mean,
no?
there's there's more of the MSG like compounds, the glutamates. There's more glutamates in like celery or tomatoes than there are in your average like chicken fried rice. So, you know. And then if you eat any kind of like potato chips or anything, well, they're just filled with MSG.
Listen, celery doesn't taste a damn thing like MSG, to the best of my knowledge. Not quite as satisfying, but
right.
I like your passionate pitch. I'll add that to the bucket of, along with Vegemite as a condiment.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't have a bottle of MSG or what's the, it's like the brand name.
Amplify.
In the US, super,
it's called like Amplify. Accent. That's
Accent.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, every kitchen should have some MSG.
So, and
you use it very sparingly. Like, you're not trying to drown out flavors. And it doesn't even have, like, a ton of flavor in it itself. It's more, you know, in the same way salt enhances your food, so does MSG. And in fact, using MSG can allow you to use less salt, which can be, you know, some people find that important.
So I'm going to pivot the conversation briefly because it caught my eye.
Please do.
So I have TweetDeck on another screen that's like off of where I look at my normal screen, like I'm looking at y'all right now. But I have another computer that has TweetDeck with a bunch of like lists and all going by. One of my lists is like just a bunch of like, not pundits, but like tech news people. Somebody just retweeted, what the hell is his name? The guy from Home Alone.
Macaulay Culkin?
Macaulay Culkin, yeah. They just retweeted a tweet from him saying, "You want to feel old? I'm 40.
Oh, that's
That's crazy. That's crazy. Wow. I don't know how to process it. That's why I had to say it out loud, because I'm just like, oh my God. And this was tweeted like 10 minutes ago. And I was just like, oh, Jesus, that's messed up. That's messed up. So he became a Broadway actor, didn't he? Is that right? He left showbiz and went to Broadway or something?
Yeah, that's off our main themes of fried food and Kubernetes. So we'd have to phone a friend. Speaking of Kubernetes, I think is Kubernetes kind of like the rest of the internet, that if you say it, there's like a new project that gets started? I think Kubernetes needs to be a thing. Kubernetes. Paul, you've been on an explanation binge on that front. Like, what are you doing lately to teach people what Kubernetes does and doesn't do?
Yeah, I came up with an idea for doing some like short digestible videos on like what Kubernetes is, and more what the components of Kubernetes are. And so if you're not familiar with Kubernetes, on the command line, there's an argument called explain. And so if you type kubectl explain and then like pod or service or any of the other Kubernetes like resources, it will actually tell you about that resource and how to use it. And so I sort of took that idea and I'm calling it kubectl explain. And it's just short, like 5-ish minute videos that are kind of talking through like what a pod is, what a service is, stuff like that. Very low level, not getting into a ton of detail, but basically some words, some diagrams, and then like a GitHub project with more or less the text of what I'm saying for folks that prefer to read like myself. And then I'll probably do a couple more of them, and then I may circle back and do like a kubectl run and have that as like the practical aspect to what I'm doing in the explanation. But for now, I'm just kind of, the goal is to do like 4 or 5 of them and just see if they're useful, see if they get some traction. You know, I'm happy to fail fast and cancel my domain subscription at the end of the year and, you know, move on as well. That's a totally valid outcome.
Yeah.
It's also really legit that you cleanse your domain subscriptions and don't just have an ongoing list like most of the internet.
So my trick is I never sign them up to auto subscribe.
Yeah.
Because if I care enough, I will remember or I will be reminded and I will resubscribe it. But if I don't, it just kind of disappears.
Yeah, that's graceful of you. Your mustache is particularly dominant in the screenshots of the videos there. I mean,
oh really?
The COVID stash is just working for you, man. But this is really impressive. Like, I know you said quick, high level, but I'm seeing a good 2,000-3,000 words with a example of a pod at the end of the explanation of pods. So
that's, it's a collection of dolphins, right?
That's awesome. And what were you using to really, do the diagrams?
Nothing.
So I was just using Draw.io inside of VS Code.
Oh, nice.
And then I'll kind of throw them into some Google Slides to sort of project behind me while I'm doing the talking. But with the VS Code integration with Draw.io, I'm basically like the minute I've finished like creating a diagram, I have an image in my Git repo that's being used in my Markdown. So it's perfect.
That's so cool.
I have thought that would be cool to, you know, maybe go the Lightboard route, and it's actually pretty easy to rig up a Lightboard, but at the same time, then I gotta have a Lightboard, I gotta lug it around, and then I have to actually use it, and there's a bunch more like post work, and then I have to save those screenshots, and I'm like, yeah, you know what, I'm just gonna stick, like, do everything in VS Code, record my screen, call it done.
So that's a nice little maybe segue into a conversation I've been having internally. And when it comes to
internally content creation, to your, like, inside your head?
No. Well, I guess work internally. But it's actually relevant to what you're doing, which is content creation. So in this COVID world where we can't be on stage talking about these things, obviously there's going to be a demand for better content creation, production value, and narratives in general, because that's how, like, you can't be on stage showing something off. You need to bring people in to create that content. Mm-hmm. Now, where do you go as a human, not as your company, but as a human, if you need to learn something new about cloud native technologies? Like, where is your first stop?
Google.com.
Google.
Okay. Believe my
sorry, Bing.
Bing, nice. Okay, now, if you want to know the technology, if you have a general idea of the technology, right, or the name of the project or whatever, and you're not going to go directly to the project page, is there a third party that you would go to the trust to give you the information?
Google?
No, man. Yeah, I mean, the way Google has been working for people lately, like, you tend to have like the shallow searches and the longer refinement searches. So regardless of where you are, and kind of, it's really a buyer's journey or a searcher's journey for content. And at first you're like, what is? And then you get into how does this work, or how does it work with? And what Google is just way better at than other search engines is giving you high quality content based on their definition of quality that tends to correlate pretty highly with my definition of quality.
So I'm gonna challenge that in really briefly. I find that the only time I get quality results out of Google is when it's either tech related stuff or like cheap garbage that you can buy.
You're saying like consumerism type stuff?
Like, yeah. I've found like the results from Google searches are so orientated towards like consuming things and buying things, but actually trying to find like, how do I like build a DIY cart for my kayak, right? It used to be you would search that and you would have like 1,000 forum hits on people talking about how to do it. Now you get like 4 YouTube videos and a bunch of stuff to buy.
I've noticed, it seems that if there isn't a perfect conversion point in the sales funnel of Google advertising, then you do get shoved towards a YouTube video pretty quickly these days. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, I mean, traffic for Bing is starting to go up industry-wide for those that follow the marketing world. Edge has a lot to do with that because it's actually a good browser. But also, I think people are getting a little sick of Googling things. Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. From like the consumerism, from the tracking, from a number of angles, I have definitely heard and seen. And I've even gotten frustrated with Google and actually opened up Bing. And, you know, usually, I don't know, I probably get about the same quality of results, but I haven't spent a lot of time with Bing. So maybe
I default
needs to be a little bit different.
I default to DuckDuckGo to be completely neutral, which is, I mean, they offer privacy and they're very open source centric. And yeah, as Paul said, of course I do. But
do you connect to your Tor onion first?
I'm not that deep.
But
anyway, I was going to say, like, there are times though when like I end up jumping to Google to get a more refined search because it when you're trying to do that longer research, like the how do I do specifically this, it'll still kind of send you to the generally high authority pages. So different objective.
So y'all answered the question in a completely different way than I thought y'all were going to. So that's actually really cool. Because when somebody asked me that question today, I actually answered by saying, I go to the tutorials on DigitalOcean. Like, that's the first thing, like my first stop. If I need to learn to do some.
But that's if you want to go learn how to do stuff from 10 years ago. Like, I feel there's a pretty good gap right now where there isn't a DO docs for cloud native.
You don't think so?
And
I found some pretty good stuff on DigitalOcean for
they've gotten better. They've gotten better. But like a lot of their docs were great. Even 3 or 4 years ago when you were still doing a lot of, oh, I need to set up this particular thing to do like authentication proxying through Apache and like Bing, they bring it up, Bing, get it?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, starting from a raw Linux, here's all the things you need to do, right? And it's not DO specific, so it doesn't matter. But like we're mostly beyond that now. And I haven't-
I think so.
I mean, I'm mostly beyond that. Like, I can't remember the last time I've needed to do that. If I can't run it in Docker and or Kubernetes, I'm probably just going to bypass it.
Oh, wow. Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you are cutting edge from that angle. Yeah. But I'm with you that DO is, like, solid on the Linux social content, socially sourced content.
Yeah.
They have, you know, a massive amount of contribution. I don't know if they still do it. Oh yeah, you get paid if you contribute. They give you some money for it, which is I think pretty cool. And they also just through that over the years they've had a great SEO strategy, so they hit really really strong points of I'm seeing a lot more Kubernetes on there though, so it looks like they're trying to ramp
makes
that
sense
up.
Makes sense now that they've got a Kubernetes service for them to start ramping that up. When I was at where you are now, JJ, at IBM, when I was helping build out the IBM code stuff, my big push there was we should make this like the like DO docs, but for like Kubernetes and cloud native.
Yeah.
I was trying to push for we should absolutely be paying people who want to contribute. It should all be in GitHub. It should all be easy to contribute to, easy to edit. Unfortunately, there were too many competing ideas of what people thought it could or should be, so it didn't happen. But I still feel like there was a perfect opportunity, and sounds like it's maybe past now for someone to be the DO for like cloud native docs.
Mm-hmm.
And I have yet to see someone really do that, and so maybe DO has kind of just fallen back into it because now they have Kubernetes and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They have some, and like I contribute to opensource.com. We've got a decent bit of stuff that ranks pretty high, but like I think there isn't like what would it even look like to be the only place that has the level that you need? Like, who are you? What do you want to learn? There's way too many personas, way too many angles to approach, way too many versions of everything out there. So it's like, we're kind of asking the wrong question. If you're like, where is the one shop for cloud native? Like, what the hell are you calling cloud native?
Well, okay. So the one shop for, like, that's why I'm saying like the like DO for cloud native, because like the DO docs are very much like systems administration / here's how to configure a Linux server to do a thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about software development. It's not about, you know, quality assurance testing. It's all about, here's how to start from a Linux and turn it into something that's useful for what you're doing.
They have a lot of stuff. So I wrote some guides on Python and I noticed it was competing with DO for the front page of Google. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of how to get Python 3 set up and how to write this thing in Python. So yeah, no, I guess you're right. I had to back my way into it, but so more tools and configuration, less like deep guides on expertise in Python.
Yep.
I've seen some, you know, web app type stuff. Like they do some JavaScript and whatnot. But
I feel like most of their stuff is at the like the bootstrapping side of things.
So
if they get deep into that, it's
Or enough for a sysadmin to understand when they're having a conversation with a developer that they've been able to get this Flask app and run it up and running or whatever, so they understand the vernacular to be able to use what they did. The more we're talking about this, the more I'm listening, the more I realize it really is the personality is blank VM to do something to be able to say that you understand how to get HA proxy up and running or whatever. So that's good. Okay. So I guess it's a different paradigm that I thought about, and I'm going to have to reprocess this to figure out how to answer this with internally.
But back to your original thought, JJ, of like, what should people who are developer advocates or technical marketers or paid to create content people be doing? I think the answer is definitely experimentation, like you both are doing with video, with different formats, and you can do that wherever. But the really essential piece after the experimentation is the integration into places of high value for the organization. Mm-hmm. Like me making really SEO heavy content, and by SEO heavy, I mean just great freaking shit, like something people actually want to read. If I go put that on yet a new site and don't, as opposed to like whatever company.com, I don't give them the traffic that adds value to them. So I haven't really done my job well enough. So and you can look at that through conversion rates and like tracking people through the sales cycle. And I think that's a gap I see a lot with developer advocacy, that, you know, you don't want to fully be in marketing for sure, but like if you're creating content and we're in this digital world, you're ultimately going to be helping with a sort of marketing motion towards sales.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely that feeling of, as a developer advocate, part of my job is to be like building my brand as a person. It's just where that fits into like building your brand as an employee of the person who's paying you, and where the importance of both of those lie and where the expectations are as to like what kind of percentage you are putting on like corporate websites versus personal websites versus, you know, devops.com or whatever other thing you try to contribute to.
You know, I've never heard
opensource.com
directly. Yeah. I mean, we have over 3 million readers per month. So I've never heard somebody say that explicitly, like that it's their job to build their own brand a little bit. Mm-hmm. I've always had that brought up as like a bit of a, for lack of better terms, like the collateral damage of the job, where like you have to let me build my brand in order to help build whatever you want me to.
But like your brand is what brings you the authenticity that the company is buying when they're hiring you, right?
Yeah.
And so you need to be able to maintain that personal brand, and you need to make sure that that like branding follows you if you move to another job, right? You know, one of the things I think about with all the streaming I'm doing is it is all through like the VMware Tanzu Twitch channel, right?
Nice.
And so that's not necessarily stuff I can take with me. I mean, it exists and it's there and that's great. But like, I don't have like a Twitch following that will follow me to where I'm going because they're on my Twitch channel. Right.
Right.
Whereas like some YouTube stuff, if I'm doing like open sourcey stuff, I'll almost always just put that up on my personal YouTube and then maybe add it into a playlist that is work related. And you know, obviously if it's very work focused, then I'll put it on the work, on the work corporate account. But like, I guess it's like who, like at what point of the funnel am I targeting this content at? Is it the rim of the funnel? Then it should probably be the, like on the corporate YouTube account or whatever. But a lot of the stuff is just trying to like give people a kick towards the rim of the funnel, right? You know, pouring them from like out from a, like a jug of rice and trying to get them into the jar, right? And so that bit, I think it's totally fine for that part of it to be, you know, outside of, you know, whatever your corporate, you know, properties are. And so whether you're doing your personal blog, your personal YouTube, whether you're putting it on opensource.com, like it's all great, right? Because at the end of the day, you're probably going to have something linking it back to where you work, or the tools you work on at work or something, right? If nothing else, your byline is there and your name is there. And that, you know, in a very small way, adds yet another piece of authenticity to you that both you and the company you're working for are benefiting from.
It makes sense. Yeah. That, yeah, I like the way you kind of build the Venn diagram of value out of this.
Right.
That it definitely works at our scale. Like we're all working for massive corporations relative to you know, your average startup, and in the startup space, you tend to be scrutinized and brought in a few more directions, to say the least. But we don't have to cover that because we're not there.
Right.
It's true.
Do you still consider yourselves a startup, Matt?
Only in my personal life, in my smoking meat business, I'm a startup, a sole proprietor at the moment. But no, I'm well out of that in all other aspects.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious because a lot of people like to like hold on to that illusion of startupness long past when they were a startup. And I'm sure there's a number of folks at Pivotal that still think we're a startup, even though we're part of VMware. Sure. I'm sure there's a lot of folks at Red Hat that feel the same way.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm just not a big delusional fan myself. I'm sure I have them. I just try to squash them as much as I can.
Cool. Well, I guess, yeah, I got nothing else. Yeah.
Speaking of content and whatnot, so I thought maybe I'd just quickly mention KubeCon was last week, and I don't have a long, lengthy discussion about KubeCon. But one thing I thought worked really well was Chris Nova did a talk about her transition, not just in tech, but between genders. And it was really like heartfelt and really good and really eye-opening. But also the way she did it, you know, virtual conferences, you know, a lot of us either pre-recording or like talking to a camera, she kind of treated it like a stream. And so she kind of had two laptops open and she was really actively monitoring the conversation in, I think it was Slack, while she was presenting. And so she was able to sort of do a lot of references to things that people were talking about in chat and stuff. And just even starting it by like saying hi to people that said hi in the chat. I felt that worked really well for what she did. And I think that might be a way we can get a little bit better at doing virtual conferences, to kind of, as the speaker, to really seek out the interaction with the audience, wherever your audience is. And I think a lot of us are missing that right now. And so we could all learn a little bit from what we saw from Chris, from many, many avenues.
I do need to say though, as someone who streams, nowhere near the amount of interaction she probably had, but I do stream. I will say there's a cognitive overhead to be able to keep conversations going, also on topic of what you're trying to show off, and the random left field questions that can come in at any time.
Yeah.
So there is a skill there, and that it's awesome to hear that she did well with it. But unfortunately, it's one of those things that's really hard to practice at the same time, right? Like, I would love to be able to...
It's hard to practice because you're not practicing, right? Well, everything's hard to practice the first 100 times you do it. 100 okay. being an arbitrary number.
Yeah.
But you don't get better at something by complaining about it being hard.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the opportunities of being able to practice of that level of communication with an audience.
Jay, you're streaming 2 or 3 times a week.
That's
a lot of good practice time.
Yeah.
You're also, didn't you just say you have TweetDeck next to your head while you're talking to people? Like, sir, what are you saying?
I don't know. Maybe I just don't feel like I have a big enough muscle on this yet or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you in theory that like it's, like, I think there's a different mindset, and you might not always be in that mindset, but like there's something to putting yourself in the mindset that as a presenter, I'm giving people a presentation. I'm like kind of on stage for them very virtually. And like, you kind of need to be multifaceted in how you approach that these days, like using chat as like, as not just like chat, but as inspiration for what words you're going to say next. And quite frankly, I'm not as strong of a reader as I am like a listener to people. Like I have some reading challenges at times. I love it, but it's still like, it will take me a second longer to process that than to banter with you. But I think, you know, I'm going to go watch her talk. I missed it live because I suck at online conferences, but I'm going to go try to learn a thing or two and hell yeah, just give it a go.
Cool.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, I guess that's a great place to wrap up, saying we should all go watch Nova's KubeCon talk. Yeah,
absolutely. If you can find it, because the KubeCon site is not super navigable for trying to find the on-demand videos, but just click around a bunch and you'll eventually get there.
Or you know, you it sounds like you already know where it is. You could send it to us, and I could put it in the show notes. Hint, hint.
Oh, it's behind like JavaScript and stuff. I can try. Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I found like you can't like right click open new or do any of those tricks on there because it's all weird script on clips and stuff. Yeah.
God. Ugh. Whatever. All right. All right, gentlemen. Well,
good to see you. Yeah. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.